Before we dive into today's discussion, we've got a special resource just for you, a free ebook called Does It Make Sense to Believe in God? In today's world, where faith is often labelled as outdated or irrational, this ebook takes a fresh look at the evidence for God. It features reflections from years of engaging with some of the world's leading atheists, like Richard Dawkins, and reveals why, after hearing every conceivable argument, our confidence in God's existence is stronger than ever. Download Does It Make Sense to Believe in God today for free at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. Now, let's get on with today's show.
From now until the end of December, tune in to Premier Christmas Radio and experience the hope, peace, love and joy that only the sounds of Christmas can bring. Enjoy hours of Christmas music, classic carols and festive favourites. Listen now on the Premier Plus app or your smart speaker. Premier Christmas Radio, the real sound of Christmas, in association with Open Doors.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Thank you for listening to the show that brings you the thought and theology of C.S. Lewis with me, Ruth Jackson. Discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, resources and podcasts. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. If you enjoy listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it. But now for today's show.
I am absolutely delighted to be joined today by Dr. Jem Bloomfield, who is an assistant professor of literature at the University of Nottingham. He's a reader in the Church of England and author of numerous books, including the one we're going to be focusing largely on today, Paths in the Snow, A Literary Journey Through the Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. Jem, let's talk a bit about Christmas. Why does Christmas feature in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe?
I think possibly for reasons of genre, that a lot of, as we said, a lot of sort of fantastical children's books are Christmassy. Mm-hmm. It's a time for telling stories. You know, it's a time for gathering people round the fire. And, you know, there are some absolutely cracking myths and legends about winter. I suspect, you know, particularly for a writer like Lewis, who is he's both steeped in Victorian writing and also steeped in Anglo-Saxon poetry and saga. You know, the idea that the winter is the time when you beach the ships and gather around the fire in the Great Hall, I suspect that fired his imagination to some extent. And it's the time when we most obviously turn to the question of the incarnation. Or we most obviously we celebrate a time that sort of that links up with the seasonal calendar and also links up with the particular doctrine that's being explored and the particular sort of worship that's being given. I think that's one of the reasons why it's a specifically a Christmas story.
And the incarnation was really key for Lewis, wasn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. Without that, nothing. It haunts his literary writing and his philosophical writing. There's a fascinating essay he wrote, and I dare say many of your listeners will know it far better than I do, where he talks about is theology poetry, and talks about sort of, you know, how myth can relate to truth. Mm. And for him, the literary differences between the Old Testament and the New Testament, between this expansive, heroic, sometimes rather cloudy, symbolic style, and the very particular common Greek reference to tying up shoelaces and going to a particular town at a particular time. For him, that is the incarnation. That is the fact that God became present and incarnate at a particular time at a particular place. You know, so for him, even the difference in literary style between the Hebrew scriptures and the Greek scriptures has something to say about the doctrine of the incarnation. He's intrigued by it and inspired by it.
And let's have a look at some of those Christmassy elements in the story, because when we first encounter the approach of the White Witch, the reader might have been expecting another character, mightn't they? Would you just say a bit about that and why Lewis used those sort of literary techniques that he did?
Absolutely. Yes. This is an idea that I had when sort of looking very, very closely at that scene, as you say, where the White Witch first appears. and further proof for my insistence that these are endlessly rewarding stories to grind through on a line-by-line basis. But yes, we've got a child who's found their way into this snowy, magical land. We as reader know that animals talk, that magic happens in this world. And this child hears sleigh bells, and they see reindeer appearing, and they see a dwarf with a pointy hat, and they see the runners moving through the slush and the snow. And I'm pretty certain that that's intended to conjure up Father Christmas. And that's a perfectly natural thing to find. We're in a Christmas time story or a winter time story. We hear sleigh bells as sleigh appears. There's a sort of elf dwarf thing. And of course, it's not Father Christmas. It's the absolute opposite of Father Christmas. Not someone with a red face and a white beard, but someone with a very white face and red lips. Someone who is not giving but taking. Or someone who is giving things that will enslave you. You know, the Turkish delight and the drink, etc. Someone who doesn't want to gather you together with your family, but someone who wants you to betray your family and to sort of use them for your own benefit. I think in many ways, the White Witch is just a tremendous character, you know, it's a fascinating piece of fiction. And in that first arrival, I think she's almost the photographic negative of Father Christmas. She's everything is inverted to an extent that sort of really summons up the idea of Father Christmas. And then a chapter or so later, when they're hiding with the beavers in the cave, they hear sleigh bells and they all look at each other and think, oh no, this is it. We've all been got by the secret police. And of course it's not. It's Father Christmas. The trick is played in reverse and they delightedly go up and find him.
And would you say just a little bit more about why Lewis paints the White Witch as this antithesis of Father Christmas?
Yeah, I think it's partly to set the tone of the story, that emphasising, yeah, her wish for power, her desire for control, the fact that she wants to drive a wedge between the children, the fact that she rules, but not for the benefit of those she's ruling, that she takes life away rather than giving it, all go to emphasise the positive things that should be happening. You know, all go to emphasise the things that could be happening, that will happen when Aslan returns. But I am intrigued by the fact that she's so clearly set up in these early chapters as Father Christmas's antithesis rather than Aslan's antithesis. Yeah. You know, you might expect those two to be sort of paralleled, and it's actually Father Christmas. And I have a slight suspicion that what's happening here is Lewis is deliberately not suggesting that there's someone who is equally powerful and a sort of negative force when compared to Aslan. You know, he's guarding, I think, against Manichaeanism, or a sort of, you know, a Gnostic approach perhaps to the universe, in that sense, which sounds a rather abstruse way to read a children's book, but you know, he was a guy who was really interested in the patristic writers and the fathers. He's really interested in theology, and the fact that Christianity has always disclaimed a Manichaean dualist view of the world. You know, there is not an evil god and a good god. There is not an equal power. The universe, you know, unlike in Norse myth or unlike in Babylonian myth, it's not a war between creatures of equal power. Aslan does not represent another great warlord or, you know, some great king. He is a thing that is not a thing. You know, he is beyond being able to be parallel to something like the White Witch. And he said, the worst witch there. there's another great children's story. But yeah, I do think that the pairing of the White Witch and Father Christmas has quite a significant theological freight. It stops us reading this as a story in which two sort of equal sides have a war and the conqueror gets the land, because that's how war works.
I was really struck by that when I read that in your book. And I guess somewhere in the sort of further echelons of my brain, it totally made sense to me. But I think I had just always assumed that Aslan and the White Witch were opposites. But you've got a great line in your book where you say, you know, you're talking about the fact that Aslan actually is this entirely different being, and you say Aslan's not another magical creature who happens to be more powerful than the witch. He's not a creature at all, in one sense, since he was there before the world was created. And that's exactly what you're saying, that actually they're not on the same plane, because Aslan is so much greater, isn't he? He's above both the White Witch and Father Christmas. And you see that a bit, don't you, with when he starts talking about the deeper magic and things that the witch doesn't understand because she wasn't there at the beginning.
Exactly this. Yeah, it sounds like a terrible bit of sort of hand waving, as I believe they call it in literary criticism. It sounds as if he's saying, you know, oh, by the way, there was a secret magical thing that no one knew except me. So surprise, I'm alive again. But it's not. You know, it's and you might even say this is where the rules of good plotting break apart, because there's a presence in the novel that's greater than good plotting. And it is actually, I think it's the only example I've ever seen of a novel that hinges on the doctrine of the pre-existent logos. There's something where he says, you know, they say, oh, the witch is so old she can remember, you know, all time. And Aslan says, well, that's fine, but she can't remember things before time. Because I was there and she wasn't. The idea of the deeper magic before time isn't just, oh, psych, you know, I happen to be more powerful. It points to something very significant about Aslan. And something that I think we can sometimes forget when reading the Bible or discussing the doctrines of Christianity. One of the things I think that Narnia does at its best is not only sort of refresh our excitement in the drama and the truth of the faith, but actually cause us to reflect on things that we hadn't noticed, or habits of mind that are not as helpful as they might be. And that bit about, you know, I joke that it hinged on the doctrine of the pre-existent logos, but there is a drama and a surprise and delight in that sends us back, I think, if we're paying attention, to think about the doctrine and its real meaning.
And one of the things that I was really struck by, again, just rereading The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, was the fact that Father Christmas's appearance provides proof that Aslan is on the move. There's obviously other little bits, you know, spring's beginning to happen here and there. But why is it that Father Christmas is proof that Aslan's on the move, that the White Witch's power is in some way waning?
Yes, as you say, there are several sort of moments where that's hinted. What does he say? You know, I've got in. She's kept me out for long enough, but I've got in at long last. And there's that long description of things melting and flowers coming up, and the line that everyone remembers from the TV show: "This is no thaw. This is spring," etc.
That was a great representation of his accent, by the way.
sort of thing we say to each other. It's. I think it's a good sort of signal of that, because he's a person, because he's someone who gives. That's his job. You know, he's a gift giver. He's someone who reflects or refracts, given what we said earlier, some elements of what we should understand about Aslan, but is not Aslan. He acts as a sign of what is to come. A familiar character. You know, we don't have to have long explanations of who he is. And there's some description, isn't there, in the book about he seems like the pictures of him, but unbelievably realer, and unbelievably jollier.
Yeah.
He's a figure that children will be familiar with, but he is sort of, you know, personal, and you can talk to him, and he represents this loosening of the witch's hold. And I think, funnily enough, he's a bit like Mr. Tumnus in that Tumnus is a sort of fawn, isn't he? He's a sort of half goat, half man. And he is one of the first people that Lucy meets when she goes into Narnia. And that's, you know, she's not alone in that. There's all sorts of Victorian, Edwardian literature in which people meet half goat, half man creatures. You know, novels and poems about Pan were very, very popular in this period. You know, you've got The Wind of the Willows with the Piper at the Gates of Dawn, and Hector Hugh Monroe, more famous as Saki, writing all sorts of stuff about Pan. But in Narnia, Pan isn't the mystery at the heart of the wood. Pan's the first person you meet. Lewis has, you know, understands this excitement, this thrill of sort of the ideas of paganism and sort of the power of nature that were very popular in the intellectual and creative life of this period. But for Lewis, that's not the heart of the secret. That is something that might interest you and fascinate you and attract you to nature, but then you discover what's beneath nature. And I wonder whether the same thing is true of Father Christmas, that Father Christmas is in this novel, because he arrives relatively early. You know, he's not the denouement, but he's another figure who is exciting and attractive, but points beyond himself.
Now, this, I feel like the elephant in the room with all of this is the fact that Tolkien wasn't such a big fan of the insertion of Father Christmas. Why was it that J.R.R. Tolkien was so concerned that Lewis was mixing traditions by inserting Father Christmas into The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe? And do you think some of his reservations were perhaps justified?
As you say, it's a great question, isn't it? That and the Susan problem, which we can shelve for another day. Yes, as you say, Tolkien clearly was having none of it, and I believe the Narnia novels are one of the major works by the Inklings which were never read at their meetings. Wasn't having any of it because of this eclecticism, this mixing of sort of ice queens from Northern European folktale and myth, and satyrs from classical mythology, and Father Christmas, and talking animals, and echoes of the secret garden and things like this. Yeah, he couldn't stand it. I think it was what appeared to be, to him, to be a flippancy to it all, that this was not taking these things seriously by sort of jumbling them all up together and, imagining that they could be part of a sort of universe of the fantastical great crossover event. If I were about this seems to not take them with sufficient coherence. And, coherence matters to Tolkien because he's got this deep sort of tragic sense of history. And I can see that. I mean, I like Tolkien's fantasy and I absolutely appreciate that sense of a coherent secondary world, what a critic like Mendelssohn would call immersive fantasy, where at its best, the fantasy world sort of closes around you and you feel that here is a genuine other world where there are other feelings and other experiences for you, etc. And that, that became the dominant mode of certainly fantasy writing for adults for decades. I do think perhaps it misses two things about Lewis's writing. Far be it from me to tell Tolkien what he missed about Lewis, but this is what it seems to me that the eclecticism is there for. It does that gathering that we talked about. It brings in the idea that rather like a medieval clerk Christianizing Ovid or explaining how it, Philo of Alexandria explaining how actually peculiar bits of the Hebrew scriptures are actually to be allegorized as moral truths, etc. It sets to work with this very medieval imagination on the sheer stuff of the world and seeks to bring it in to tell the story of the Saviour and to sort of reconcile it in the light of the Logos. And secondly, I think Narnia is always facing towards our world. It makes sense that we meet characters and images in Narnia that we know from different parts of our world, because Narnia is not seeking to sort of draw us in and close around us as Middle Earth is. It's supposed to send us back. I mean, one of the first things that Lucy is asked is, are you human? Are you a daughter of Eve? There's this moment where she meets a magical creature who's half a man, half a goat, and he thinks she's far more fascinating. He's far more struck by the wonder of being an actual little girl, a genuine descendant of the Lady Eve, than he is by the fact that he's a fawn living in a magical land where there are witches and stuff. And I think that eclecticism is part of that one of the great things that Narnia does is enchant our world and make us take the world more seriously and more mysteriously than we perhaps did do before.
And it gives real value to the child reading the book, doesn't it, as well, I think?
Absolutely, yes. It doesn't say, well, you should forget all that nonsense. Now you should learn about the six houses that used to rule wherever, or, you should sit down and be told how magic really works in this universe. Exactly that. It says, well, you did know. And in fact, at his best, Tolkien does precisely that. The first books of, first chapters, I should say, of The Lord of the Rings have an awful lot of Frodo finding that things he knew are in fact more significant and deeper. That Gandalf is not the Gandalf he thought he was, that even Barlaam and Butterbur is actually, running messages for the resistance, basically. Yeah. Farmer Maggot is actually someone who's keeping an eye on the strange marches of the Wild Wood. I hadn't thought that. You're absolutely right. It validates and gives respect to that literature and then shows what more it can do.
Yeah. And just to be clear, Tolkien did then recommend the Narnia books to his children and to his grandchildren.
Indeed,
so there was,
yes,
there was no bad blood there. Let's just make that really clear on the airwaves. They didn't fall out over Narnia. They didn't fall out. They were still friends right to the end.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
We're going to take a quick break now, but if you are enjoying today's show, please do consider rating it and leaving a review on your podcast platform so that other people can discover it too.
As we approach the end of the year, I want to take a moment to reflect on the incredible work God has done through Premier Insight in 2024. This year, we've launched new podcasts like Rico Tice's and provided impactful books and resources, and we've shared the powerful N.T. Wright videos to help people grow in wisdom and share their faith with clarity and compassion. But this ministry wouldn't be possible without you. Your generosity has equipped countless believers to live out their faith. Right now, we face a $112,129 funding gap that must be closed by December the 31st to sustain this vital work. Your gift today will not only help us finish this year strong, but also lay the foundation for exciting plans we have for 2025. Visit premierinsight.org to give today. Together, let's make an eternal impact for God's kingdom. Thank you for your generosity. And now, let's get back to today's episode.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Welcome back to the show. We would love to hear your thoughts and ideas. Do get in touch on social media at Premier Unbelievable. Now let's return to the conversation. One of the things that we think about when we think about Christmas is obviously the period of Advent, the lead up to Christmas. I mean, one of the lines that comes through again and again in Narnia is always winter, but never Christmas. Mm. Does that in any way echo where we're at with Advent, do you think, Jen?
Entirely, absolutely. The image that that always sort of strikes me when we think about, you know, always winter and never Christmas, is that medieval carol, you know, Adam lay bound and bound, for a thousand winter, thought he not too long, and all was for an apple that he took, as Clark has found and written in Hillebocca. I can't be certain, but I've got a strong suspicion that Lewis had that somewhere in his memory when he invented a world in which that's literally true. It's a great part of his creative imagination to take a symbol or a metaphor and make it literally true. You know, that the Saviour is the Lion of the tribe of Judah. No, he's literally the Lion of the tribe of Judah. Okay, good. the land is under 4,000 winter, thochti not too long. No, literally, 4,000 winter. So he enchants the world by making metaphors true. And of course, that to me is one of the most perfect Advent songs, because it's all about the nativity. Or the incarnation, I should say. But sorry, it's about the incarnation, but not the nativity. It tells you all about it, and it never shows it to you. It's one of the reasons, I think, why we sing it and recite it in Advent. And absolutely, in fact, though it's a classic Christmas book, the Christmassy bits get over fairly quickly. You know, we have these lovely sort of cozy meals beneath the snow, but the whole trend of the novel's sympathy is to say, no, winter bad, you know. Yeah. We want spring, we want the rising, you know, we want Easter. You know, Easter is the season that determines the two-thirds of this novel. And actually, I think that's true of the Narnia novels more broadly, because one of the things that the characters do in this book is do their best, and they travel and they try to rise to their heroic destiny. But they're waiting for Aslan. It's a novel about, it's again, a huge failure of plotting if this was any other novel. They spend their time waiting for someone to come and sort it out. They don't have to solve the problem or, you know, do the quest themselves. I mean, they have to quest and they have to solve problems, but they're not going to be the ones who sort it out. And he doesn't come in and, you know, and smash everything up. He dies on the stone table. And then in Prince Caspian, we have the same thing again. They're called to a high destiny to put Caspian back on the throne by waiting for Aslan for most of the novel. They are Advent novels. They're novels about active and wonder-filled and awful in the older sense, you know, awe-filled waiting. How to wait passionately, how to wait excitedly, how to do things whilst knowing that the doing you're doing is a form of waiting. And, you know, and you'd see this, the fact there's no nativity imagery in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. You know, if you want a donkey and a stable, you can find it in Narnia, but it's going to be in the last battle. Yeah. it's such a, again, smart twist of his imagination, because the moment we see the most cliche nativity imagery is at the apocalyptic war. You know, it's the moment when reality is being torn apart, when the world is ending. And that's very Advent, isn't it? You know, the Advent is the season of waiting for the festival of the Nativity whilst waiting for the second coming. That's always been the dual meaning of Advent in the church's year. And so I think at the risk of saying a heresy, it may not be a Christmas novel, but it may be an Advent novel. You know? It may be a novel that gestures towards the idea of Christmas feasting and Christmas festivity. And then its actual plot and the plot of the whole series inducts us into Advent.
Well, and let's just talk about that a little bit, because as you say, so much of the imagery is very much Eastery. So like the stone table, the reference to the deeper magic. Would you say just a little bit about the significance of some of those elements, the Easter elements in the book?
Absolutely, yes. And it's during those sequences, you know, Aslan's sacrifice and resurrection and then the romp they have across Narnia. And the raising of the statues, that the biblical sort of textual connections really click in. It's really noticeable that the closer it gets to that sequence, the more you can trace specific biblical passages. And for Lewis, the atonement is tremendously important. You know, in Mere Christianity, he talks about it as the idea. You know, for him, it's the entry point to Christian thinking and the Christian view of the world. And then, you know, other doctrines and a Christian approach to life sort of comes afterwards. He thinks it's the contact point with people who can't see the world in a Christian way, who haven't got faith in Christ. So for him, I think it makes sense that his writing gets more sort of biblically locked and more close to that as he gets through. And it's, you know, it's an extraordinary symbol, the stone table, because it combines several biblical images in one. For a start, it's a very dramatic visual image because it's something that you come across in the British countryside. You know, it's a megalith. It's like Stonehenge or Avebury or something like that. It's another astonishing moment where a biblically infused narrative is happening, but it's happening in a sort of mythic Britain, a sort of almost Arthurian world.
Yeah.
You know, the world of the Boxer Delights and Warrior Scarlet and all this kind of stuff. But the stone table itself is the means of his death, so it's the cross. And of course, it's also the broken tomb. It's also the symbol of the rising again. And it's also the veil of the temple. And it's also the breaking of the graves at the moment of Jesus' death. You know, he's really gifted at finding these resonant symbols and then layering different things on top of each other. In the same way that your man Edmund is Adam, who eats something he shouldn't do, but he's also Judas, who gets up from the table and leaves his companions to go and betray them. You know, he's at various points, I think he's even possibly Lucifer. You know, he gets very, very, very prideful and very obsessed with no one else should be as great as he is. The stone table is extraordinary symbol. And then we get the romp across Narnia and a sort of combination of Pentecost and the harrowing of hell in the witch's castle, where he talks about the breath comes on the statues and he says, oh, and actually that breath was rather like when you touch a match to a newspaper. And nothing appears to have happened. Then you see the flame licking and you're thinking, oh, I see. So coming alive was a bit like breath and a bit like flame, was it? And again, a marvellously lively and everyday sense of what it is to be enlivened. And that imagery of, you know, the giant breaking down the gate and the people being set free from the witch's tyranny. You know, you see this in Middle English literature about the harrowing of hell. There's a play in, I think, the York Cycle or the... I should really know. One of the great mystery play cycles, where it's staged exactly like that, where it's staged as a castle where the saviour actually arrives and sort of breaks in the gates.
Brilliant. And one of the things, as you were talking about... Edmund there and the sort of multifaceted nature of his character, one of the things that really struck me was his name, Edmund the Just, which feels so, well, wrong in many senses, doesn't it? But you had some really great insights about their names, but I think I was particularly struck by what you said about Edmund.
Yes, Lewis just loves the depth and the length of words. Mm. There's this one of his best books is Studies in Words, where he takes particular terms and traces the way that they relate to their etymologies and also the way people use them differently and how their meanings changed across the centuries. And I think all the regnal titles of the Narnian monarchs are a sort of pun, mm. in that Peter is the Magnificent. Well, in the modern sense, that just means elaborate and stylish. You know, maybe he makes magnificent shots at cricket or whatever. But in the medieval sense, he is magnificent. He's an achiever of high deeds. You know, he's someone who lives up to the way a king should behave. Susan the Gentle, again, quiet, softly spoken, not bothering anyone. You know, an English schoolgirl of mid-century who is gentle. But if you look at the medieval meaning of that word, it means of high birth, a noble lady, you know, of genteel kind. Mm. She can be Susan the Gentle when she's hunting a stag or shooting arrows at her enemies. Those are appropriate things for a high-born lady to do. Lucy the Valiant, you know, she partakes of both the modern meaning of that, but also the older meaning that a valiant thing will not be moved. Mm. That she's tough to shift. She'll stand out for her beliefs and for her God. And as you say, Edmund the Just, a title that seems absolutely unacceptable. You know, he's betrayed his family, he's lied, he's been a glutton, he's been prideful, he's caused Aslan to be killed to get him back. But of course, he is the most just because he's been justified.
Yeah.
You know, he's been made just. It's a great title. And I think it offers the children a chance to be their Narnian selves and their selves in our world at the same time, giving them a title that has different meanings, but which they can sort of participating in both worlds, I think speaks to this this sense that Narnia is directed towards our world, that it's always offering us an image of what we could be.
Mm. And as you point out so well in your book, it's really significant that the novel ends in our world, not just in Narnia, isn't it? And the final words of the professor that this is probably not the end of your Narnian adventures.
Absolutely, yes, to my mind, entirely true, yes. It could so easily have ended at the coronation at Caer Paravel. Or it could have ended differently, that they were in the Golden Age and they were having a splendid time and they were marvellous monarchs, but they started hankering after our world. You know, Susan starts accidentally using the English names for things rather than the Narnian names for them. Or Lucy starts having dreams about something that they realise is a steam engine. You know, you can try all kinds of versions of this, can't you? but it's not. It's the moment they enter our world, it's the moment they are most Narnian. Mm. They've done this very Arthurian thing of hearing of the white stag, you know, going on a hunt like the way Gawain and the Green Knight begins. And if you look at the way he describes it, he uses this very sort of faux medieval phraseology. It's terribly heroic and terribly chivalric. He even breaks into what is basically alliterative medieval verse whilst writing prose at one point. And it's that moment where they're following a quest, where they've made a decision that they don't know where they're going, but they're committed to it, and they're being drawn on by this thing they don't understand. And then they enter our world. it's their most heroic and their most questful moment. Yes, and if we look, you know, if you read it carefully, it turns out that our world is the end of the quest, or you know, if not the end, in that sense, the purpose of the quest, the telos of the quest. It's our world that we're brought back to with all this venturesomeness.
Well, Jem, just as we finish, we're approaching Christmas. What can we learn from Lewis about Christmas, and what can we take into our own celebration of Christmas, the way we talk about Christmas?
What an excellent question. I keep going back to the word generosity, actually. I forget which literary critic used it of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. It is a generous book. I mean, Michael Ward would say it's a jovial book. Mm-hmm. You know, he believes it's governed by imagery of Jove. It's magnificent. It's kingly. It's giving. And I think those are things we can find in Christmas. You know, I don't think it's not an original idea, but I don't think we have to turn away from festivity in Christmas in order to reach its truest meaning. I think I can understand the impulse, and I can see the impulse to sort of cut things out of Christmas, to try and pare it back, to try and turn away and invent our own Christmas that's properly Christmas and actually about Christ. I understand that, and there may be indeed value in that in particular cases. Lewis, however, shows us something else where you go through the festivity and you go through the, you know, the frippery, so to speak, into something deeper. I think he's, and that's also true of his literary style, right? He doesn't pare things away and then explain the real meaning. He adds more and more things. You know, he's creative and he shows how they reflect the goodness and the glory. That, I think, would be the Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe approach to Christmas, to look for generosity and munificence and to see gift-giving as perhaps participation in the season, that it is a season of a gift, not to say, no, that kind of gift is not a real gift. To see gift-giving and feasting and celebration and the love of family and the desire to make this a genuinely special day that, my word, can drive all of us mad at times. but to see the, you know, the desire that it must be a special day as a hint of something greater, of participation in that sense that you know, there was a truly special moment, something when reality itself changed, even if that is not perhaps evidence in trying to work out which of the in-laws we're going to see on which day. but our desire to get that sorted and our desire to make it work can be a hint that it is genuinely, you know, a shadow of something greater.
Well, Jem, no, that was very helpful. Very helpful. Jem, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting to you today. How do we find out more about Paths in the Snow, some of the things you're up to?
Oh, thank you. Paths in the Snow is available, as they say, from all good booksellers. and a few bad ones, I should dare say, but I don't think there's such a thing as a bad bookseller these days, is there? And Goals on the Horizon, which is the next two volumes, is out this coming weekend, so probably is already out at the time which people are listening to this. I write for various periodicals and things. I also tweet, so I'm to be found on that platform. But yes, and I'm usually to be found disappearing back into my study to read more literary echoes.
Brilliant. Well, I'll make sure that there are links to all of your various bits and pieces on the show, so people don't need to look it up. They can just click on the link on the podcast. But Jem, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. It's been an absolute delight.
Thank you for listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast with me, Ruth Jackson. Many of the topics that we've touched on today are discussed in greater detail on earlier episodes of the programme. Check out our archive of past shows at premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, videos, and podcasts. Plus, if you register on our website or sign up for our newsletter there, then you will get exclusive access to new content, free resources, and more. That's premierunbelievable.com. What did you think of today's show? Are there any topics or works of C.S. Lewis that you would like us to explore next? We would love to hear from you. Send us an email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Connect with us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @PremierUnbelievableFE, or drop us a direct message on Instagram or Facebook @PremierUnbelievable. We have also recently launched on TikTok, so if that's your thing, or you know anyone else who might be interested, then you can find us there @Premier.Unbelievable. Your feedback and thoughts are so important to us, so please get in touch. If you're enjoying the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it on whatever platform you're listening on, as it helps more people to discover the show. Thank you for listening and see you next time.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at tanger.com.